integrative oncology, as the talk is here, is really just, I think, the crux of all integrative medicine. Whenever I treat integratively, and oncology is no different, okay? The probable issue that most people have is they think of cancer as being something so separate, so different, that only unique specialists can handle that. That's disintegrative medicine, and that's true in so many other systems of medicine, but of course we're focusing on cancer tonight. I have continued therapies, not just past my board certification in internal medicines, and I have fellowships in anti-aging and regenerative medicine, and fellowships in integrative oncology, et cetera, et cetera. So I have a lot of training in this, and I've barely scratched the surface of the knowledge necessary to really feel adequate to do a talk like this. Okay? Anybody who does enough research really just continues to find how much they don't know. But at some point, you got to start talking anyways, because there's a lot of things. And, you know, this was a couple of weeks ago when I looked at the handout that an oncologist had given one of my patients. I mean, I had to cringe at the advice that was given to them. And you've got to start saying something to people about the importance of nutrition and exercise and all the things that essentially the oncologists are not well enough trained in, nor do they care to look at it enough, because the literature in their own literature supports a dramatically different conclusion than they come to. So people have to be, the well-informed and educated and their own best physicians. So a goal of a talk like tonight is to discuss cancer in terms of what the diagnosis means in a very broad sense, not in a very specific sense. And I really request, please ask questions as we go along. But if you have a very specific question about you and a specific cancer, ask me afterwards. If really try to keep the questions on spot with what we're talking about. Otherwise, I won't even come close to being able to cover what I'm trying to cover. So, integrative oncology will even discuss what I mean by this talk. So, this book right here, I suggest to anybody. I think it's a brilliant book. It's written for the general public by the Dana-Farber Institute, one of the hematology-oncology fellows that went there. His last name is Mukherjee. And it discusses the full name of this is The Emperor of All Maladies, okay? And it really is an autobiography of cancer. A biography of cancer, and not an autobiography. And so subsequently speaking, and it starts off with this little quote, which is just straight from the American Cancer Society statistics, but I want to bring up this book as something that I really encourage people to look at. Whether you have cancer or not, anything else, it's a well-written book. It really talks about some of the history of medicine, and I'm actually going to use that because it really brings to the fore the issues that we face as people who have cancer, people who we know who have cancer. So these are pretty grim statistics. And the most impressive one, including in the United States, probably within 10 years, cancer will surpass heart disease if heart disease survival rates get better. And cancer, we've had such little success in treating, and the part of that is because of the way we define it and the way we approach it. I'm using this great, and I love some of the quotes from the beginning of this chapter, and I think this is the way we look at, and this goes back to Hamlet, right? And I think this is a great quote because we do. When there is the diagnosis of cancer in front of us, we tend to think desperate measures, and we act desperately because of it. This is another quote that I think really is the heart of the problem as well, too, is that cancer begins and ends with people. So when I talk about integrative oncology and the doctor treating the person with cancer, you'll find that most cancer treatment is quite dehumanizing. It's about treating a disease, and the person who has that cancer is kind of just something in the way of us treating the cancer. Okay, and many people have had that experience because they think it's necessary, and that we just treat tumors, we don't treat people. But that is not true. We treat the person who has the tumor. And that's the crux of the problem in terms of especially doctors' training, is how does a profession so focused on treating a disease, an entity, also treat the person individually? Because we're taught not to look at you as individuals. We're taught to look at you as a statistic, a grouping of people. Okay? cancer, the definition. And again, some of this is fun. And again, some of this is from the book and from other sources as well, too. So we all know carcinosis comes from the Greek word for crab. And carcinos meant any cancer, any swelling in the body. The many people thought, because some of those obvious cancers in the past were these hard lumps, these scaly things, and it seemed to have the carapace of a crab. Or people felt they could feel it spreading in their body, very crab-like in nature. So the symbol of the crab cancer has come along a long way, and is a part of our underlying mental structures for most of us when we think of cancer. And so it comes from a very simple word that actually meant swelling. Okay, that's really what the doctors were originally treating. So let's look at it from a more Western doctor definition. What is cancer? And you might think this part isn't important. I kind of emphasize to you, this is the key aspect of our discussion tonight, is what are we talking about? Because the standard definition of cancer, a malignant growth or tumor caused by abnormal and uncontrolled cell division. Okay, terms that are similar to it, that aren't the same. By the way, this slideshow will be on the website in a day or two. Okay, so we used to do a lot of handouts, and I'm glad people can take notes and things if you want to, whatever works best for you. But again, these terms will be up there. I'm not going to ask you to memorize them tonight. Neoplasia, novel, inexplicable, distorted growth. And then, of course, another term for cancer, pathological hyperplasia, where cells acquire an autonomous will to divide. When I say these definitions are old and incomplete, that the working model, even from the doctor who writes the Emperor of All Maladies, he's trained in that the cancer is all about growth. Okay? However, it's not. This is another book, Customized Cancer Treatment, Ralph Moss. Ralph Moss, PhD researcher, brilliant in terms of his ability to collect data, synthesize it, and has written quite a bit on cancer, many, many other books. And cancer doesn't grow too much, it dies too little, is an understanding that came about, especially about in 2002, with this thing called, and this Nobel Prize will run about this thing called, now recognized as a disease of tissues that don't necessarily have excessive proliferation, but lack the ability to perform a normal cellular function known as programmed cell death. The real issue for cancer, for most cancers, isn't growing excessively. It's that they don't have the normal signals for programmed cell death. And this is why, you got to emphasize this, a treatment focused entirely on stopping growth, when that's not the underlying problem, is doomed to fail. And why the only real successful cancers that have been treated are the ones that do have hyperplasia as the primary part of it, the leukemias, the rapidly evolving things. So when I say the previous definition is partly correct, hyperplasia is a part of cancer, but the loss of programmed cell death really is the key dysfunction in cancer. And it has to guide the way we approach cancer for the future, because the therapies that we use to stop uncontrolled cell growth cannot work if you look at this definition. And that's why that's so important. And this is a really interesting number. The 50 to 70 billion cells die each day due to programmed cell death. Okay, and that course of a year, this adds up to the entire weight of that individual. That's an important process, programmed cell death. Another term that is often used synonymously with this is apoptosis. Okay, I just want to point, apoptosis is just one of the ways by which programmed cell death occurred. But it's one of the ones that is in the literature so much these days, and you hear it. It's not synonymous, it's just one of the primary ways that your cells are supposed to have this programmed cell death. When something goes wrong, they're supposed to do the whole Mission Impossible self-destruct thing. Something's gotten in the way of that. Okay? And this shift in understanding of cancer from being unregulated cell growth to dysregulated programmed cell death is still what's confounding our thinking, because we don't know how to treat that very well. And here's the key. Many of the things we find in nature that work are biological response modifiers. And all that means is they help your body turn on programmed cell death. So, and this goes into one of the key parts of nutrition. Every, you know the old saying, you are what you eat? a lot of truth to that. But it isn't just about fats and calories and those types of things. When you eat foods, they literally are talking to you. Your extended environment, the world in, outside of you, is coming into you and having a full-on conversation with your DNA. Okay, makes you think twice about deep fat fried butter. Okay, that's one hell of a bad conversation. Okay, or something else like that. So you want good, fresh, organic foods talking to your body, because some of the issues with the way foods are being processed is the conversation they have with us give you very dysregulated signals. Okay. Oncology. Where does this come from? Comes from the Greek word for burden, okay? The Greek word for mass, load, burden carried by the body. So cancer was felt to be that. So the oncology became the study of burden, the weight that we're carrying. That's really what oncology is about. Other terms to be aware about, okay? Metastasis, beyond stillness. When a cancer has spread throughout the body, it's metastasized. Many people come in and think they have, somebody has bone cancer and liver cancer and things, and it really is just one cancer that's spread some other place. It's the same tumor, okay? So, and I love this one quote, "The image of the cancer as our desperate, malevolent, contemporary doppelganger is so haunting because it's at least partially true." And this goes into the kind of the X-Men approach to this. Is a cancer the more perfect version of you because it's stronger, faster, and can think past things? In some ways, yes. I mean, and just in some ways, okay? So it's able to respond to the environment more rapidly and protect itself better than you can in some ways. It's still you, though, okay? Now, this is where I want to go into, and it's when I was going through this, part of these slides, by the way, are slides when I'm teaching other doctors, especially naturopaths, but ever MDs, what integrative oncology is. And I'm trying to make sure I don't go over the top with things, but I want to make sure people understand where the role is in terms of the integrative approach to cancer. All right? It can be overwhelming because obviously cancer isn't one disease. There's multiple types, and it and as you well know, there's some people who specialize in just one kind of cancer, and that's it. So when we're talking about somebody to help you deal with all forms of cancer, that's quite a daunting challenge, okay? Just like it's daunting for your surgeon to know enough about nutrition, or the oncologist to know the oncologist to know enough how to treat a person, because the chemotherapy routines that come in and day out and day in and day out, they are not trained to treat you as a human being. They're trained to treat the cancer which you have. That's part of their training, and it's not, it's just the way it is. And so, now, again, and another part of this is there's an underlying thing, especially from the doctors, that if you do something outside of surgery or chemotherapy, you're just doing quacker, you're doing weird things, you're doing the things that aren't proven by science. I'm going to show you the sordid history of what Western medicine calls science, and you'll have to have a really rethinking about anybody who chooses to do Western therapy as being the greatest quackery of all time. Okay, you have to start thinking about it because it's actually quite true. If you look at Dr. Halstead, I knew about Dr. Halstead as in residency. When I was a medical student, chance to cut is a chance to cure. It's one of the first things I learned. I love surgeons because they're gung-ho. They go into this world with these kinds of characteristics, a large part because most surgeons and the basic tenet of all Western surgical approaches was by a drug-addicted wild man, okay, named Dr. Halstead. Okay, and the approach that your doctors use were done, he well documented, he went between his morphine and his cocaine addictions, and he was superhuman, and he made anybody who went through Johns Hopkins act like him. Okay, so when I tell you that, and he used the term radical, not from a standpoint, he wanted to uproot cancer, because he uses the root word radical, because it was the root uprooting cancer was what he was about, okay? He just felt that if he dug deeper, cut more, he would get better results, okay? And I don't think he did it malevolently. I think he really, truly believed in what he was doing. And so did all of his followers, okay? And that's what they became, followers. Because when you hear about integrative oncology in today's world, surgical oncologists were it for the longest time, and they would smirk upon anybody who would give chemotherapy, thought it was ridiculous. And they actually actively fought any trials that even suggested that their stuff didn't work. Anti-scientific medicine. Okay? Because when he did from 1891 to 1907 and looked at his own data looking at radical surgery, when he found lymph node positive surgery on surgery, he found his radical surgery did nothing to improve survival whatsoever. So what I want to point out to you, in 1907, it was proven that radical mastectomy didn't work. The approach of the oncologist who went kind of unchallenged was to just dig deeper then. Okay, and the radical mastectomy got worse and worse and worse from a standpoint and from a misunderstanding of what cancer was. It wasn't something that you could find. If it had gotten to the lymph nodes, you had to think of it as a systemic disease. And if it was a systemic disease, you couldn't cut it out surgically. Surgeons didn't like to think of it that way. It took from 1907 to 1981 before finally the U.S. even had to recruit patients from Canada because the surgeons in America fought against any trial looking at the surgery, okay, to finally show that the radical mastectomy was no better than simple mastectomy or simple lumpectomy with radiation. It took that long. I'm not against surgeons. This is just part of their training. But I got to emphasize to you, every time you think that when you go to a surgeon, you're getting science-based medicine, you're not. You're getting really the continuation of a drug-addled mind teaching the American surgeon to go more aggressively without any scientific evidence whatsoever. I'm not trying to be down about this, but this is just what you're getting, okay? And that's what the science proves. Now, did radical mastectomy drop off after 1981? Yes. But most of the other radical surgeries that came in its place still haven't been as adequately tested. But you are finding surgeons being much better at being less aggressive these days, but for the most history of surgical oncology, that really wasn't the case. And trust me, most of those people thought they were getting the best medicine. So, you're looking for which lemming? So, does everybody understand that part of it? Okay. And what I'm asking you is not to distrust surgeons or distrust hematology oncologists or radiation, but it's very interesting that I often get people say, well, what proof do you have that whatever so-and-so works? And I don't see anybody asking the same thing of the people who went out to perform 500,000 unnecessary radical mastectomies because it was just considered to be the best medicine. Yes?
Dr. Forsman, in the early protocols that don't want
to die. Well, again, I'm going to generalize the question. More it's about, can we get our immune system to do the recognition of tumors, whether it's killer T cells, macrophages, other antigen-presenting cells, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, because that's the real essence of the question. And the answer is up to a certain point. What you'll find, and this is where cutting out a tumor can be useful, is if once you get to a certain volume of tumor, somehow, some way, it overwhelms the functioning of your immune system. Okay, you need to get down to a certain critical volume before your immune system seems to be able to switch back on and recognize the cancer as non-self, deranged you. Okay, early on, the idea, though, is every day we're all forming, 10, 15, 20 cancers every day, and we're eliminating it. So our immune system's been doing this all along. We just weren't aware of it. Okay, and so for somehow that right combination of mutations came about and escaped your immune surveillance. Okay, but one of the approaches to cancer is improving immune surveillance. Okay, so medical oncologist. A medical oncologist is a specialist who, and this is a Western chemotherapeutic approach to oncology only. Now, this is the most troubling definition you have because most people understand they don't necessarily need wide, big surgeries, okay? So, and I think in today's world, the radical mastectomy's kind of gone away, et cetera. But the question is the only thing I can do chemotherapy? Because that's what the Western oncologist understands. The Western oncologist is not a specialist in cancer treatment. They're a specialist in cancer chemotherapy. And it's really important for you to understand, if that's all they know how to do, are they going to tell you how to do acupuncture or herbs or anything else like that? No, they're not trained in it, and they shouldn't mention those things that they don't know about. unfortunately, the further you go into your training, especially in hematology oncology, especially the when the oncology fellow in this book describes what he went through, and he doesn't go to the near the depths of how horrible what that training is like, you get inculcated into a way of being that this has to be the only thing that is to treat cancer is chemotherapy. You don't want to believe. I've been through severe residencies, nothing to that severe. You want to believe the only thing that you, that can work is what you've been trained in because you've bled that residency program. Okay, and so it's understandable. But when you actually look at it objectively, you know, and this, I even knew this story before I read this book again and reminded of it. The first chemotherapeutic cure of any cancer, choriocarcinoma, was done by a doctor at NIH, and he got fired for it. Because he actually realized that cancer was systemic, and he took this person who had choriocarcinoma, which is it's a tumor that forms at the time of pregnancy, and he measured a tumor ant marker, and he kept treating with chemotherapy even after there was no signs of disease. And he said, as long as this marker is here, I'm going to keep treating. That got him fired, saved his patient's life. Okay, I want to point out there's a long history of not following what's necessary to what's considered to be dogmatically true to get the right results. And so, but we do have success. So some people say never use chemotherapy. For heaven's sakes, read people. ALL, leukemias, lymphomas, testicular cancers. There's a lot of tumors where chemotherapy is the best option. And they've taken some of the most horrible cancers and made them curable. So anybody who says never to do chemotherapy just doesn't understand. And there are those people out there. A lot of people say that chemotherapy is wrong. Okay, no. In certain cases, it's right. Just like if you ever hear people say, never take those antioxidants or whatever else, that's not correct either, okay, when you hear platitudes. So, however, when you look at solid tumors, and what's the difference between these? These are the ones that have much more rapid cell growth as a problem. These solid tumors primarily have the programmed cell death issues, and chemotherapy doesn't treat that. It can help decrease the size of certain things, but it can never get to the point of actually eliminating the underlying cancer. So, 65 years the chemotherapy has been around. So it's been a while. That's kind of my point. And what is the influence of the pharmaceutical industry on physician practice? And we're going to cover that in a little bit. Radiation oncologists. And again, there's many roles for radiation therapy. After lumpectomy to save... So you can save having to do radical surgeries. Brain irradiation in leukemia patients because you need that to prevent recurrences, and it goes on and on. There's many roles for radiation therapy, and thank heavens for the radiation therapists of our world who know how to use radiation in the appropriate dose for the appropriate tumor. Okay, so once again, do you need to have these people on your team to talk about what kind of treatment for your cancer? Yes. I'm not saying to do all of them, okay, or as far as that goes. Sometimes there's a way where we use neoadjuvant chemotherapy. We actually give chemotherapy, sometimes radiation, before surgery. Then we do surgery. There's many things that you don't need to know about, but these things can come together for very powerful cures sometimes, okay? An integrative oncologist, and this is a new term. I mean, I want to be clear about that. And whether we use integrative cancer therapies, integrative oncologist, is the idea that we need someone helping people get through the morass that's out there. All right. And why is that? Most people, your primary care doctor, you get diagnosed with cancer, you get sent to the specialist, and they don't want to have anything to do with you. They don't want the liability. And furthermore, it's a complex subject. They don't really talk much about it. And I'm speaking in generalities. There's, of course, exceptions. But on average, most internists, most family practice doctors wash their hands of cancer. They know you're going to go to the cancer specialist. You don't get any help from them, okay? What you do get help is from everybody on the internet and everybody else telling you about the latest tea, herb, colonic, whatever else like that you got to do because my aunt, you know, Matilda from whatever, you know, had a cure with it. And you get overwhelmed with data, okay? So you need someone who really can look at the data, you know, a doctor that can tell you, hey, these are the things I can need to do nutrition-wise and exercise-wise and stress reduction-wise to help my treatment. And that's where an integrative oncologist comes in. I hope to train more and more of those types of people other than just myself. There's programs through the American Academy of Anti-Aging Medicine. So if you ever wonder, it's worldhealth.net. There's a Dr. Rosenberg And he's the training people in the fellowships like I've been through. And there's a lot of docs out there that are interested in doing this very thing, because we really do see cancer as kind of a crux in terms of where integrative medicine has to become more powerful a force, because it's actually where Western medicine has its greatest potential positives and its greatest potential negatives. Okay. So that's what we do. Okay, and unless you know all this stuff, you better not be doing it. And that's the other thing. There's a lot of information to understand in this area. It truly is primary care for the patient. And so, and it's how to make sure you can use these things in conjunction, even sometimes when the radiation therapist or the hematologist oncologist is warning you, don't take any of those things. I already told you that sometimes the most frightening information comes when they start telling you to do all kinds of things that work against your cancer. And so we need to figure out, why is that? Okay. We are truly the border collie. Sorry. Now most of you know I like Far Side. So we're meant to organize things, because you don't know what to eat, where to stand, or anything. Okay. That's your integrative oncologist. Yes. Integrative oncology is for all cancers, including the things like the leukemias. But let's use leukemia as an example. You know, I saw a lady today, and she is 5 years past her son having ALL, acute lymphoblastic leukemia, and he's doing well. Okay, so if my son, and I said the same thing, if my son had leukemia, dang well, we'd be getting combination chemotherapy and a bunch of other things to support their body while they're going through it. Okay, so, but the primary role there would be to make sure the oncologist is part of it. This, to me, things shift, because as the patient has the solid tumors or the metastatic cancers where really Western therapy has completely failed, especially the endocrine oncologist now being more aggressive in their approaches, and things that I'm not even going to talk to you about, using off-label uses of medicines. I'll throw the kitchen sink at this stuff, okay, and if I think it'll work, make it as safe as possible. So I'm not telling you not to use medicines. I use off-label medicines when I'm treating cancer, when there's no chemotherapy option. The issue here is, you know, one of my favorite quotes from Dr. Rosenberg, he's gone around the globe because everybody's interested in the metabolic approaches to cancer that he's talking about. Another thing I'm not even going to talk about tonight. And he said, you know what? It fascinates me when I go to China and South America and goes like that. He says, the only country in the world where you can't do anything to treat your cancer is America. We have the least freedom of any place in the entire universe. Okay? Isn't that fascinating? The world of the free, and you are limited by the pharmaceutical / money interests to not be able to do what you want to for a life-threatening illness? I mean, don't you find that kind of like shocking, amazing, horrible? I mean, it's astounding. We're the only one. China, you can do it. Yeah. China, you can do anything you want there. Why? Because they understand, man, this cancer, if I were you, I'd do anything I could, even if it was quackery and, you know, toad's venom and whatever else like that, okay? I mean, toad's venom has some interesting properties, by the way. But, you know, well, we're not going to talk about that either. So do you understand? So, wow, what a fascinating thing. So, but to kind of organize all that is very difficult.
What do you mean when you say usually used?
Correct. Not usually used, or it's been come about for other things. So a medicine that's a copper chelating agent that can be used as an angiogenesis inhibitor. Sorry, in English. That means, okay, there's a certain medicine that can be used that wasn't intended to be used as a cancer medicine that you can use, and it's again, relatively safe, and it has to be monitored. There's a medicine called naltrexone, and if there's a website called lowdosenaltrexone.org. Take a look at it, and how you can work with your endorphin and enkephalin system, which is your own natural opiate system, in terms of working with cancer, etc., etc. These things will never be studied in our society because there's no money to be made in them. That's the only reason. Now, that doesn't prove that they work, okay? It doesn't prove that they don't work, okay? But the problem that we're facing is that we're left with an industry that is entirely about these multi-bazillion dollar drugs that have very little chance of actually working, but they have a large potential to make money, whereas these other therapies have very little chance of making money, but a huge chance of working. And just, again, and I'm part of this, I'm an MD, okay, so I'm part of this industry, so I am told to only use evidence-based medicine, evidence-based medicine doesn't mean there's evidence. It means that there's a drug or a surgery that can be tested by double-blind, placebo-controlled, randomized clinical trials, and that's the only thing I'm supposed to use, and I'm supposed to throw away the entire history of knowledge in medicine because that's the only right thing to use, and that's supposed to be called evidence-based medicine. It's not evidence-based medicine. It's a way of inculcating, indoctrinating doctors to stop thinking and giving you drugs and surgery. Okay. Do we want evidence? Of course we do. Come on. Okay. So, general principles of therapy, and I'm not going to spend too much time on this, but not because it's not important. The amazing transformative power of cancer to heal. I saw a lady today who we don't know for sure that she's cured from her breast cancer, okay? But the lessons, and she listed three separate things in her life that she had found because of her cancer that she needed to address, including her own self-worth, willing to be loved, all these things that came out of her diagnosis of breast cancer. Do I think that she, and again, this is my belief system, do I think learning those lessons take away the energetic template that forms the background for why people develop cancer? Yes, I do. Do I think there's other things involved as well? Yes, I do. Okay. So the lessons she learned from these things in terms of neutral self-inquiry, which is, I wonder what this means. And I'd tell you, I'd do that whether it was a stub toe or cancer. Cancer just catches your eye a little bit more. Okay. And when we talk about healing, there are people out there who have it's something like 6 hours of TV a day that an average American watches. Wow! Okay? Wow! Talk about putting something into your body, because you aren't just what you eat, you're what you watch, right? And if you watch what a lot of people are watching out there, Kardashians sound like cancer. Something like that. Anyways, so think about it. So, filling your visual fields with those things that are healthy for you is a wise idea. You probably have heard of the studies that look at people who are post-operative and look out into a park-like setting versus a parking lot, and they can have less pain medicine, and get out of the hospital maybe a day earlier for the same surgery. So what you're looking on can help you heal. Do I have the same study in cancer? I don't, okay? But man, it sort of makes sense to me. Do I want to wait until I have a double-blind placebo-controlled trial before I'm looking at things beautiful? No, I like looking at things beautiful. Thank you. Okay? Be conscious about it, though. Okay? So, auditory. Is there music deficiency out there? Yes. Okay? So, when people don't have the right rhythms, can we get people to go to war over music? Can we have people feel like a funeral dirge? Yes. So, are we using auditory system consciously? Most people aren't. Singing bowls are wonderful. Mitch Gaynor is an integrative oncologist, and when he's giving chemotherapy, he has the singing bowls working, and he swears that he has a lower rate of complications and all those other things without any double-blind trials whatsoever. People like it, though. So singing bowls are a wonderful thing in terms of having the right acoustic frequency for balancing your energy body. That's basically what I would tell you. That's what a singing bowl does. Smell, using the right sense, taste, touch. Touch deficiency is rampant in our society. We have so many people who have so many issues, not just with sexuality, with intimacy in general. Okay, the pornography industry makes more money than all of Hollywood. Okay, so what is going on there? A lot of people have unhealthy issues with how they feel when they're being touched. Okay, and do I think the skin, the entire body, has a number of things that activate immune surveillance and all kinds of other things? Are you having touch deficiency? It's a great question to ask yourself. Intimacy deficiency, it's a great question to ask yourself. And so, do I think that those deficiencies and or excesses, remember both sides of things, you know, too much heavy metal, okay, too little good music, whatever, or, you know, I'm not trying to pick on heavy metal. It could be Garth Brooks or something like that. There's all kinds of irritating stuff out there. That was specifically from my wife from Nashville. Anyways. But that truly is, beauty is in the eye of the beholder, right? So what's one person's beauty is whatever. And so, anyways. I really do believe a lot in this. I've had many, I'd say especially women with breast cancer, I've had some amazing transformations that have occurred in women who've had breast cancer who really said, wow, and they've made dramatic differences in their life, and they've been so much healthier after their diagnosis than they were beforehand. Now, nobody would ever wish this diagnosis on anybody. I hope you understand that. But man, can lives change in a very good way because of this disease? Yes. And because of any symptom or any sign. Okay. So, is laughter good medicine? Yes. Okay. I don't know if it's the best one. Okay. And it has to be used appropriately. Questions so far? I'm not trying to do too heady, but, you know, so, again, don't lose sight of this. I mean, does laughter deficiency exist almost probably as much as intimacy deficiency? Yes. So if you think Seinfeld is funny, get on Netflix or whatever else and start streaming Seinfeld into your home, or Lucille Ball, or whatever you think is funny, because laughter is really good medicine. And why would you not do all of the systems of healing? Because most people think, and I'll be right there, most people think that healing just has to do with a pill or an IV. You're so wrong. It has to do with all these senses and changing the way your biology functions. And you never know. The Institute of Noetic Sciences, another great group to look at. If you look at spontaneous remissions, you can't tell why one person, because it's not the cancer that's in remission. It's the person who gets the cancer into remission. And how they're going to do that is different for each person. Right. No, there's many great anti-cancer essential oils. Limonene from citrus is one of those examples, especially for adenocarcinoma. So true essential oils have great anti-cancer properties. Now, do the fragrances have potential cancer-causing properties? Yes. Valerie Warwood, she's written many good books, WOOD, and she's a great reference for essential oils and how to use WOOD. Not on Glade.com would be my guess. Wikipedia, which is the answer to everything, of course. Just kidding. The Environmental Working Group has the best data regarding toxins in our environment. So look up Environmental Working Group. That's the best source of information. Correct. But true aromatherapy, essential oils can be profoundly beneficial for immune system function. No, I'm not talking about the candle, the paraffins that are burning so horribly with fragrances. That's not healthy. Now, there is some benefit if you truly enjoy something. So the joke in the essential oil world is, what's the benefit of vanilla? And the answer is none. It's just vanilla. However, if you love vanilla, my guess is it's probably beneficial for you. Okay. So, now, we're getting into some issues. Now, we're getting more scientific. Oh, sorry. Yes.
Well, just in terms of...
Yeah.
So, I think it may have some...
I would agree wholeheartedly. And so, there's actually... in Ayurveda, they use many sounds for healing. And one of those healing sounds is that huh sound as well, too. And there's something probably within the sound that's generated, the energy. And I agree with that, too. But I'm saying I think there's many beneficial parts to that. And so, and I do agree with the shift away from fear, because when I talk to people about learning from cancer, the self-inquiry process can be quite a damning process. People blame, let's say somebody has lung cancer and they smoke. Okay. And so, you know, do they have to take responsibility and go, huh, I wonder if this could have been part of this? Well, yes. Okay. If you start blaming yourself and going into this and then going into, well, it's because my dad smoked too, it's my dad's fault, and then you're just getting into the name and blame thing, okay, which is not what we're talking about. But can you take a moment and say, huh, well, that's a part of it. Well, what decision will I make in this moment and the next moment and address that, no matter what it is? It's about being kind of really supremely responsible in the moment. And so, now, meditation, and these are just some references about how to learn. Everybody here knows meditation instructor, meditation, single most important thing we can do individually or collectively as a species. I've said that a million times now. and so, does meditation have a role for treating cancer? And the answer is yes. And so, and the dosage, I recommend to everybody who's healthy, a half an hour, twice a day. of a meditative practice. I can't tell you how to do meditation any more necessarily than I can tell you how to exercise. There's as many ways to meditate as there are ways to exercise. You have to find something that works for you. The TM group has the most research. There's no doubt about it. They also have the most money. Okay. And there's many things. There's a stress management article. Look at stress. All right. There's so many people who can relate stressful incidents to their cancer, and stress has a profound negative effect on your immune surveillance. So stress has an absolutely biological, plausible role in being part of why your body may develop a tumor, okay? This is just M-wave technology. There's so many things. You can use technology-based to ancient-based. That if you, the best thing I can tell you, if you've tried a meditative practice and it hasn't worked for you, then say, huh, I wonder if this kind of meditation, I tried progressive relaxation and it wasn't the best thing for me. Does therefore all meditation suck? No. The answer is progressive relaxation might not be the best technique for me. Let me try this. Just like if you tried racquetball and didn't like it, does therefore all exercise suck? No. Not a good conclusion. Let's try something else. Okay. I can't go to, but this is a very good study that was looking at breast cancer and stress. There's, in what I'm going to tell you, you can measure how stressed a person is by adrenal stress profile, doing salivary tests throughout the day, and looking at their cortisol curve. Okay, when somebody is really stressed and not doing well with it, they'll have a flat cortisol curve. I mean, it'll be kind of too low in the morning, but it'll stay, and it won't drop normally. It won't have a steep curve like it's supposed to have. So Dr. Sapolsky, who's famous for his work on stress, okay, says, looked at these people and broke people down with stress patterns, trying to find something physiological, not just saying how stressed do you feel. So he wanted a physiological marker to see if we could predict mortality based upon this diurnal cortisol profile. And what he found was this. The people with the normal slope survive significantly longer. And these kinds of curves are as much as you can. This is for breast cancer, by the way. Published in the National Cancer Institute, 12 years ago now, okay, and basically looking at steep slopes for same stages, etc., and you could find a very significant difference in survival. So, yes, stress makes survival shorter. There's no doubt about it, okay? The studies on stress reduction are very difficult to follow all the way through, compliance issues, etc. Most show, at least when they do a meditative technique, TM and others, you can get improvements in quality of life. Only a couple have indicated improvements in survival. Okay. It's like the study that was looking at women with even a support groups. Some support groups seem to help survival. Some support groups seem to make it worse. And if you've ever been to a support group, you'd believe those results. Okay? Some seem to be very supportive, and some seem to be overtaken by people who aren't necessarily have health as the main outcome. So do I think that different support groups would have different effects in different trials? Yes, and that's exactly what it shows. It doesn't mean support groups aren't useful. This is another study that looked at when you got diagnosed with breast cancer and looking at somebody who felt isolated, basically they didn't have, versus people who lived in group housing, okay? The people who felt isolated had 84 times the burden of breast cancer at time of diagnosis, lower estrogen progesterone levels, abnormal cortisol responses. The abnormal cortisol response correlated with a tumor burden. Isolated women don't do well with breast cancer. Part of the reason why we all know that there's a slight difference in the way we stress. The classic thing is fight or flight response, especially for men. Tend and befriend is a more classic feminine response to stress. It's very important, especially for women, and I'm talking in generalities now, okay, for women to have community, and it makes a difference in their survival. Nutrition. So, this is, again, just an overview. Medical oncologists, they are under tremendous pressure to use medicines, and they do ignore the data in their own literature, and I'll give you proof of that in just a second. And sometimes people who give these nutritional recommendations really overstate the benefits to their patients. I have many people who come back to some clinic in Mexico who had 100% cancer response rate, and they seem to have a more rapidly progression towards death, and they think they're like the only person because they supposedly had 100% success rate at this nutrition clinic or whatever else like that. most people don't tell the truth about their statistics, and they'll hide behind a lot of things because they want to have you come in and do their whatever their treatment program is. So it's very difficult to get good data from the nutrition-based people because often they've been kicked out of the country too, and that's part of it, okay? So it's very difficult to get good data. That's all I can tell you. And so this does leave the patient confused and disempowered because you have the medical oncologist saying one thing and the nutrition-based people saying completely different things. And the person's already stressed. We've established that. And it's so difficult to take this information in when you're not feeling overwhelmed. Okay. So, this is a funny slide, sorry. So really, official should be the way, instead of supersizing things, is the exact question that should be asked afterwards. High fructose corn syrup, absolutely free fructose, strongest correlation with obesity and with cancer. I'm not going to spend too much time on this. I just had this the other day when somebody came in and their thing says, above everything, avoid weight loss during your treatment. Okay? So, and the nutrition that was given to this person who was going to go through chemo included sweets, margarine. I mean, it was, you know, like, but don't eat things that, you know, like might have grown in the ground because they might kill you. I am not kidding you. I mean, they were being killed by someone. They're told to limit activity, just rest. Okay, I'm not kidding you. Now, I've had patients take it to extreme. I had a lady who was this big step aerobics person, and she didn't want cancer to get her. So she literally, on days of chemotherapy, still did her step aerobics class. Okay, and I said, please, chemotherapy is like step aerobics, like beyond in terms of stress to your body. She made it through about two of those before she realized this wasn't going to happen anymore because chemotherapy makes you know, step class like nothing in terms of stress to your body, okay? You don't want to overdo it either, which is rarely the issue, but, you know, she learned the hard way. This is a long slide, but this is actually the WINS trial, and there's a women's intervention and nutrition study and the women's healthy and education lifestyle study, and I'm very briefly going to go through those things, but what I want to get to is some very key points that were brought out in this, is that there was a doctor who did this WINS, it's not WINS study, who did a great thing in looking at dietary fat and specifically looking at weight loss, okay? And basically the results that doctor did a very well, nice conducted trial, reducing dietary fat, saw the same kind of magnitude improvement in disease-free survival that we have with chemotherapy interventions, okay? But he lost his funding somehow. Interesting. Okay. Do you bring this up with your patients? Well, not really. Okay. Next slide. And it goes into that when somebody has a sponsor, a pharmacological agent, and this was looking at a study that showed that there was a marked reduction in rate of exercise, relapse rate, almost a 50% decrease in relapse rate in people who exercise. If this were this drug that failed in this one thing, everybody would be using it, okay? And this is the thing. Yes, it is interesting how that works. You have to have a sponsor, okay? So that's the truth of the world today, by the way, is that the evidence for nutrition and exercise are right there. There's just no sponsors. Okay? It's the truth of it. And so there's huge ties, and this is just a quick study. This is true for the cholesterol education program. This is true for the people who make all the recommendations on how to treat breast cancer. There's actually almost never even one doctor that isn't tied to a pharmaceutical company that ever makes these recommendations. Never. That's called a conflict of interest, in case you're not aware of that. So, but you almost can't find any doctor who's doing the research that hasn't been funded by trials. So it's like you'll never find it for the most part. Doctor's interest in nutrition. Going into, and this is the beauty of medical school. Going into medical school, you're naive. You think nutrition plays an important role. And the more you go through freshman, junior, senior year, and if you're a senior planning a specialty, you went from having about three-quarters of thinking nutrition important to maybe one out of four thinking that nutrition is important. See how good medical school is at changing the doctor's minds about the importance of nutrition? Okay. And the greater the specialization, I cannot emphasize this enough, the more the doctor has been indoctrinated into believing that nutrition is not important. Okay. Cannot emphasize that enough. So why do you ask your doctor for nutrition advice? Think about it. You can't. It's, again, you've all heard me give my examples of asking for sex education advice from the nun. It's not a good idea, okay? So, or some variant thereof, okay? There's certain authorities and things. That's not where you go for information, okay? Nutrition. So what do you eat? I always wondered where the boneless chickens came from. Those chicken nuggets and things, you know, has to come from something like this. So, the general treatment principles, you're supposed to be your own best authority. People will go into so many extremes and they have so many beliefs about nutrition. I'm just give you a brief example from today. I saw one guy who had high cholesterol. He went on this diet where he juiced greens, okay, and he started eating 8 eggs a day, okay, and because he was intolerant of so many other things. His cholesterol dropped 200 points. Eating 8 eggs a day. Once again, eggs don't cause high cholesterol. That's been pretty well documented anyways. Saw somebody a little bit later, his cholesterol gone up 50 points. He started eating 2 eggs a week, and he and his daughter were so convinced that that was the cause of his high cholesterol, he wouldn't even talk about anything else. I'm going to cut that out. That'll do it. And, okay, we'll just check it out down the road, you know. And so remember, 8 eggs a day guy dropped 200 points. The person eating 2 eggs a week thought that that caused their 50-point increase. We have so many beliefs about diet that have no validity whatsoever, but you have to work within people's own belief systems. And so when you're dealing with cancer, if you do eat meats, make them organic and wild-caught and listen to your own body about how you respond to eating them. That means listen to yourself before, during, and after. And if you respond well, better energy, do well, then meat can still be okay despite T. Colin Campbell and China studies and all those other things. Do most Americans overeat meat? Of course, especially processed meats and things. Do I prefer this kind of diet? Yes, but that takes away from your individualization. So whether you decide to juice, whether you decide to be vegetarian, whether you decide to eat more meat is dependent on you, because there's not going to be any trial ever determining what nutrition you should eat when you have whatever cancer. It'll never exist. Okay, so don't ask people to give you a diet. You become a conscious eater and give yourself a diet. That's the way to treat this. Okay, start with some basic information. You know, do sugars feed cancer? The basis of the PET scan is giving you a labeled sugar and seeing what takes up the most rapidly. So if you're giving yourself high processed carbs, sugars, which raise insulin levels, the average amount of insulin receptors on a cancer cell is about 25-fold higher than on a normal cell. You are absolutely unequivocally feeding your cancer by giving yourself sugar, raising your insulin levels, and pounding it into your cancer. Does that sound like it makes sense? Probably not. Okay. There's so many factors involved, but yes, you got to start with something like that.
Where do statin medications fit into this?
Whoa. Statin medicines. Statin medicines are cholesterol medicines. It's quite interesting. Statins, the Lipitors, Crestors, and those drugs of the world block an enzyme known as HMG-CoA reductase. That's the rate-limiting step in cholesterol synthesis. What that basically means is it's a enzyme that's profoundly regulated in the body, and when you block it, you can get a gazillion types of effects. As it turns out, statins have a curative effect in some cancers and a causative effect in others, which is kind of what you'd expect because there's so many effects. Statin medicines can work as anti-HIV drugs, anti-candidal agents. They do a lot of things out there, okay? So it is quite a gamble when you use a statin medicine because you don't know what you're going to get in that person, long and short of it. But there are some treatment protocols for colon cancer that incorporate one of the statin medicines because there's some evidence that it actually helps. So the carte blanche statement that statins cause cancer is not true. It can cause cancer, and as a matter of fact, it can act as an anti-cancer agent.
The sugar causes natural
fruits? Not as much, because, again, that's why I'm really careful. If you do juice with cancer, I really say prefer vegetables, not the carrots and things like that. That's really the way to go. If you start pounding apples in there, you're really burdening yourself with sugar as well. So you have to be very careful with the dosage. There's an old natural medicine that saying that my mouth is my juicer, and I really kind of like that one, okay? And there's some benefits to juicing berries. So juicing, yes, because as most people, if you throw a berry in there, let's face it, most people go bump, bump, you know, two or three chews, bump, okay? Do you get as many nutrients as if you pulverize it in your juicer? The answer is no. You can actually get higher levels of the good polyphenols and other things. There is some validity to juicing in terms of getting higher extraction of nutrients into your body. There is truth to that. You have to be careful about people who are doing very sugary juices, though, because they can actually start to develop levels as high as some of the sodas and things if you do just apples and those types of things.
But in a whole food, it's okay.
And, well, depends on doses. So focus more on vegetable juices for cancer than fruit juices.
Right, but a whole apple is better than apple juice.
Absolutely, yeah. Yes. Yeah, but that's the thing is, I mean, I love apples, and I can eat one at a time, and I don't want another apple. I mean, it's just kind of its rate-limiting step is, you know, it's placed in this package to say, hey, dude, that's enough, okay? And, you know, probably, whereas if you pulverize it, you can get five or six of those suckers down you, okay? So, something like that, sorry. So, all right. This is important. How important? This is people who are greater than 20% over ideal weight or people within 20% of their ideal weight looking at disease-free survival after breast cancer. And notice how dramatically it drops off. So the idea, most Americans we know in the last 30 years have become overweight. So people who are overweight definitely need to lose weight when they have cancer. All right. So the idea that losing weight during cancer, so many people still want to desperately cling to weight, like it's like, and they're giving themselves Glucerna and Sure and Boost and these horrible like non-foods to make themselves gain fat. That's not good for them. Okay. So, another great thing is looking at all-cause mortality. Okay, and one of the greatest predictors isn't the stage or anything else like that. It's what your BMI is, and if you're over 30, 25 to 30, this is your survival curve for all causes, not just breast cancer. So this is really important. These are in standard cancer journals, by the way. This is nothing, you know. So do you see how profound weight affects your survival? So you see how important you getting something like cancer should immediately say, wow, if I've got 100 pounds to lose, I better get right on that, okay? Another study looking at this. Weight gain. You maintain your weight. The relative risk is 1. For each, just again, you gain less than 2 kilograms per meter squared. More than that, again, you just look at the in these, how, your risk of dying goes up and up, and almost double if you gain 10, 15 pounds. Okay, so gaining weight, really bad idea when you have cancer. This is another really, and I'm, again, probably doing too much. This trial looked at women with the most aggressive cancers, ER and PR negative, okay? And in this trial, the main thing they got them to is cut down dietary fat and lose some weight. And you notice that they had a profound 64% reduction in overall mortality just by getting that intervention alone. You can't even come close to get that with Herceptin, Avastin, or any of the other multi-million dollar drugs. Okay. Don't worry about this. It's about the weight loss. This is another trial just documenting. This trial did not show many benefits, but the big difference is weight did not change. This trial, weight just changed 3 kilograms, and they got significant benefits. Weight loss is the key. Whether you're eating fats or vegetables, it's really losing the weight is the most important part. Exercise can be more important. This is another great trial looking at overall metabolic equivalence, meaning intensity of exercise during the week, and breast cancer prognosis. This is the trial that the other doctor in the previous study was looking at. And there's a dose response. Moderate intensity exercise improves survival about 50%. Okay. And then as you exercise more heavily, this is like walking about 5 hours a week. Okay. And you increase more, you got no further real benefit whatsoever. And this is not statistically significant, but probably no harm. But I do have to think that there is just from going, this is like just from going sedentary, which, by the way, notice that's what's the largest group? The completely inactive group, okay? All right, just moderate amount was a very small portion of people. So moderation and everything. I know this is a lot of slides, but this is just the survival curves and noticing the difference in terms of the colorectal specific cancer death. If you exercise at this intensity, you had a significant improvement in overall survival. There's just so many trials on this. I just have to get through. So this is the deal. The exercise doesn't have a sponsor. Nutrition doesn't have a sponsor. But the advice, and seriously, I have the handouts from the oncologist. The advice to go out there that your diet doesn't matter isn't true. To not lose, seriously, the recent handout, don't lose weight. Do you see those trials? Don't exercise. Do you see these trials? they're actually more profoundly beneficial than you can get out of doing chemotherapy for the same diagnosis. All right. And the greatest thing, for the exercise, yes. For the weight loss, no, it's about the BMI. And so for people, it's about maintaining weight if you're at a normal BMI. Okay, great question. But the exercise, yes. This is just a break slide. I just thought it looked funny, and I just wanted to throw it in there. So I don't like those Myers-Briggs things. This is the only personality type that you really ever need. All right, let me just get through a couple of other things. So, stress reduction, exercise, good nutrition. Kind of foundations of health stuff that I tell everybody. Do I think it's more profoundly important for people in prevention? Yes. Let food be your medicine, medicine be your food. Great idea, okay? But once you start to get something like severe, especially metastatic cancer, you need more than just food. Okay, I'm going to be clear about that. I don't think that's enough. But this stuff has really kind of been thrown under the table because there is no sponsor for it, and you need to look at this. You can make a better difference with doing some of these things than almost any of the like I said, chemotherapy regimens, primarily for the solid tumors. This gives you much better survival rankings than you do from adding any kind of additional chemotherapy on top of something if you have a metastatic cancer. Solid tumors. Studies outside the U.S., there's lots of studies that look at the cohorts out of Glasgow and Heidelberg and the EPIC cohort studies, and those things are more about primary prevention. They do more studies about the primary prevention of cancer, and they have great studies on the use of supplements and exercise and things showing these very same things. It's really interesting. In Europe, they've shown – here's a very brief thing. 80% of excess mortality can be taken care of with four things. Okay, and this is a very European trial. The first one, being a non-smoker versus being a smoker. Okay. Second thing, following a Mediterranean lifestyle diet, that kind of diet, nutritional program versus any other form of nutritional program. Okay. Being active versus being sedentary. And you're going to love this one, very European. Drinking versus not drinking. Who do you think survives more? That's right, the drinkers, okay? And in their trials, alcohol drinking is every bit as important as not smoking, exercising, and having that size. This is, you know, and their trials document that because they've looked at, you know, over decades now, and those things correlate better than blood pressure, diabetes, obesity. I mean, anything else that you want to think about, those are the ones that best explain excess mortality, just those four things. Okay, so the European trials really, there's some others, you know, that look at, some of the trials that looked at chemotherapy and things, they actually had to do in Italy because nobody in America could do them. So, you know, but they pretty much are right in line with what we just talked about. All right, this is a basic thing. This is not a supplement talk. I mean, there are tons of supplements I put on people who have cancer. But one thing I wanted to make clear to you, especially if you go through chemotherapy, especially if you go through radiation therapy, that is just death to your gastrointestinal tract. If there's anything you can get someone to do to prevent complications from chemo and radiation, is do very simple things. Heal the gut first. We have all PowerPoints on this. And yes, you have to look at specific foods for certain people, clearing pathogens from their body before you ever want to do chemotherapy on them or radiation therapy on them. And this is a huge thing. It's its own talk. I am only, in terms of antioxidants on oncology, I'm just going to spend a little time so we can do some questions. This was a review in Cancer Treatment Reviews in 2007. And this is things. It looked at all 19, any trial that was out there that was randomized and using any form of antioxidant in conjunction with chemotherapy. And it was a variety of things, glutathione, melatonin. You can read those things right there. Every single study showed an improvement in survival and a or no change in survival, improvement in tumor responses, fewer toxicities. Every single, now this is what I got to emphasize. Your doctor says, don't take antioxidants. They'll get in the way of your treatment. Every single clinical trial in humans has shown just the opposite. That's all I'm going to tell you. Okay? Because they aren't looking for evidence-based medicine. They're looking for drugs. Because actually, the drugs that are being, there's several drugs being developed right now which are antioxidants that your cancer doctors will be using soon because they're drug antioxidants. Okay?
They can't sell as much
Exactly. It goes into the things that there is a lot of evidence that we're doing a lot to promote cancer in our country. But the evidence is there. Their doctors, it goes, let me answer that question more specifically. Why are doctors still doing this? The same reason that the radical surgeons continue to do more and more radical surgery. They just believe so strongly that more surgery, a chance to cut, is a chance to cure. The doctors who do chemotherapy are so ingrained that that anything out there is not important. I got to emphasize, we've been taught. And if you've been brutalized, you know, every night, every other night call, etc., and you have yourself, it's a form of like torture, okay? That's what residencies are about, torturing you into believing something. They really are. And so, if you've been pounded that hard, you have to believe in it, because you don't want to come out of a training program like that thinking, damn, that's a bunch of bullshit. You really don't, I promise you, okay? It's the only logical conclusion, but man, I spent a lot of time doing this. So what do? You say, wow, then everything else is bullshit. And you get stuck with what, and you don't, and this is, if you don't see it, you can't believe it, okay? That's what doctors think. They don't see this stuff because they don't even look at it. As soon as something came up on a doctor's cancer treatment review that had anything to do with antioxidants, they would have flipped the pages. They would have never read the study because it doesn't fit into their belief system that it could be useful. That's why. I'm not going to worry. Ascorbate has very unique properties. Alpha-lipoic acid can help. C-L-carnitine can help. Quercetin can help. High-dose IVC can be used in conjunction and has been studied extensively. Now, this goes into just the reason I left this slide I'm talking about. There are two. There's actually one other that's not used, so I'm not going to worry about this other chemotherapeutic agent. There's two drugs in chemotherapy that have been studied that intravenous vitamin C should not be used concurrently with. See, that's an adequate understanding of when not to use IV vitamin C. IV vitamin C is dramatically beneficial for radiation therapy patients, dramatically beneficial for almost all other forms of chemotherapy, with these two exceptions, which it doesn't too surprising. If something can help, every now and then it's going to interact negatively with something. That's, and by the way, the methotrexate study, especially in rat and rabbits with lymphosarcoma, got so much published that IVC did make rat lymphosarcoma much worse. So if you're a rat with lymphosarcoma, don't use IV vitamin C. There are supplements to avoid. Folate, methionine, and B12 are considered tumor promoters. Remember, they are. I mean, the first study on chemotherapy used a folate agonist, something, a folate kind of drug, and it dramatically worsened the leukemia. That's why we use antifolates right now. Folate and B12 are great for DNA repair, okay, in the prevention of cancer. This is why the multivitamin studies are so powerful. Multivitamins in a population that doesn't have cancer, a really good way of helping prevent cancer. If you already have cancer, you can actually make it worse with just a multivitamin. Okay, so that's why, because what selectively uses the folate and the methionine, the cells that are growing the most rapidly, which are the cancer cells. So you have to be extraordinarily careful with those agents because they are methylators and they help with the cancer and promoting its own growth.
Does that hold true for blood cancer, leukemia?
Especially for those.
Especially.
I would not take folate, methionine, or B12 if I had a cancer that was in the process of active treatment. Now, you always get to that point, well, if I think I'm cured and I want to be generally healthy, when do I make the transition to incorporate those things? And I tell you, I'd really get some good whole foods and get those as my source of nutrition for those types of things. And I'd use other nutrients, but I wouldn't use something that I thought was a growth factor. And without any trials proving that. But there are studies, the European trials on folic acid show exactly that. But what they did show is, and this was a great study, one of the trials. And it actually showed that if you had a multivitamin, if you had started at the baseline, your risk of cancer could be up to 60 to 70% lower than the group that didn't take the multivitamin. But if you started somewhere within the trial, it's a 12-year trial, you started it somewhere in the midst of the trial, your risk of cancer went dramatically up. Okay, which is the sick vitamin user. Some people start taking vitamins when they don't just feel quite right, okay? And you're actually taking something that could promote the growth of the tumor, and it didn't cause it. I don't think folate and those things actually cause these tumors. They just bring them to the fore earlier than you would have seen them otherwise. Yes?
I was just reading again,
Right.
And you have to have...
And on average, that would be true if I was a vegetarian and I had... If I was a vegetarian and I had a diagnosed cancer, okay, I would measure not a B12 level, a thing called a methylmalonic acid level, sorry, but that's what I'd measure, and I'd see if I was truly B12 deficient. If I was personally B12 deficient, I might give low doses enough to up my own thing so I wasn't B12 deficient, but I wouldn't stay on chronic supplements. But I'd document whether I needed it or not. Because it's the things. On average, will you tell vegetarians to take B12? Of course, because they have high rate of B12 deficiency. However, if you actually had to actively, because this is a difference. Remember, there's a difference in prevention versus treatment. And that's when I get to one of the slides I have to, at the end. There has never been a disease ever in the history of humanity that was eliminated through treatment. It's only through prevention. Okay, so, and you got to emphasize, you know, and let me show you some of the stuff. And I'll get to that. But would I be on B12 if I was a vegetarian with cancer? And the answer is only if I documented an actual deficiency. Oh, but there's no proof that taking supplements, Mayo Clinic lung cancer trial, people with median non-small cell lung cancer, double the lifespan. Oops, wait a minute. I thought supplements were horrible. No, actually, in the Mayo Clinic, they've shown that taking supplements of any kind actually showed some benefit. Now, they actually were taking some multivitamins in here, which most people feel that because the studies, they couldn't have power to look at it because the people on the folate and the multivitamin did not have an improvement in survival in this cancer. It was the other antioxidant vitamins that showed the benefits. I want to show something very simple. Omega-3 fatty acids. This thing here is the control group, and this is the tumor growth in animals, again, but notice when you give the chemotherapy known as doxorubicin and the omega-3s, you got a very similar results. Doxorubicin, a chemotherapy agent, along with omega-3 fatty acids, profoundly better response than, especially than control, but better and synergistic effect together. All I'm trying to point out to here is that if you notice omega-3 fatty acids had a very similar effect in terms of tumor size and tumor growth to a chemotherapy agent, okay? And when you combined it, it didn't have a negative effect. It synergized, which is, if you understand the way omega-3 fatty acids, you'd kind of assume that was the case. So something as simple as good omega-3s can have an actually treat cancer, not just prevent it. Curcumin. This is basically breast cancer metastases to the lung in a mouse xenograft model. This is the way we study these things. And basically, if you just give them nothing versus paclitaxel, Taxol, very profound chemotherapeutic agent, curcumin was better than that. The combination, curcumin, one of the most synergistic herbs ever in terms of use with chemotherapeutic agents. Not an antagonist, a synergist. Okay. Do you understand why now how especially the advice not to take supplements during chemotherapy is so wayward and so far off data? Okay. Now, you might say, well, yet there's been a double-blind placebo-controlled trial showing that curcumin improves mortality. It will never occur. So if you're going to wait for that and you look at where our survival is right now, you'd have to make a little leap and look at the biologically plausible stuff and start incorporating it into your life. Okay, magic bullet approach. The only thing I want to do, because I have to finish up, is do these statistics. This is cigarette consumption in the United States. The average adult, every American still over the age of 18, is averaging 1,691 cigarettes a day. That's cigarettes a year, excuse me. A day. See, and that's just not good for you. I don't care how you slice it, okay? I don't even know how you do it. I mean, it's all you do. I mean, alternatively per year. We had chain smoking. I have prishes back here. So are we? Remember how concerned the tobacco companies were that once everybody American would find out, you know, oh my gosh, what would happen to our sales? It's affected American sales a lot. This is the global, and I'm just going to focus on this. This is cigarette consumption across the globe. Okay, it's going up and up and up and up and up. Okay, yes way. Okay. If you think, now American tobacco sales have gone down because of course, like everything else, the other countries are making growing tobacco at less expensive than we can, but that doesn't change things. The world is smoking more and more. If you look at this slide, these animals had the brains the size of a walnut, okay? Okay? We can explain this behavior, okay? However, we have all the information in the world, and we still are taking more. Do you know what the advertising campaigns in these developing countries are? Grow up. Be a strong man. Be an independent woman. They're using the same advertising techniques that they did on us in the 50s, and it's working. And we're supposed to have brains. Isn't that frightening? No, seriously, think about it. And if you look at that statistic, there is no possible way we will ever find a cure for cancer. That's what ain't going to happen. Why? Because we're causing too many, and that's just one thing. If you look at our obesity rate in our country, high fructose corn syrup, I could do all these other types of things. So prevention is the only way we're ever going to find a cure for cancer. And every bit of evidence is we're so far away from it. We're not engaging our intelligences and taking it into action. We don't do the things that we need to, and we do still kind of wait for doctors to come around and say, hey, will you cure me? Because that's what this proves, by the way. And I know we're, you know, picking on the rest of the population. These people all, China is the leading amount. There's a lot of very brilliant people in China, okay? So does this have anything to do with truly with actual intellectual intelligence? No. It has to do with something called wisdom that seems to be dramatically lacking, okay? And so when you think about tonight's talk, I really want you to think about, what is wisdom? Is it needing? Because we already have double-blind placebo-controlled trials proving not to do this, right? Okay? And we're doing it at epic amounts. This is looking at all countries. The United States is down, okay? This is like, I think we're fifth, we're still fifth in the world in terms of countries, in terms of per capita. China and Greece and Turkey and a few others have, you know, outstripped us per capita, okay? But we're still fifth overall because we have a lot of people. And so when we look at data like this, see, these poor guys just died out of climate change. It wasn't their fault. or this, I don't know, you know, I don't have a real proof of this, but think about what our behaviors are in the here and the now. There are great evidence that good nutrition, stress reduction, good exercise can profoundly prevent cancer. Guess what? Can actually treat it too, okay? So, and what you need to do is understand that if you or a friend or anybody else has a cancer diagnosis, it's a great time for transformational change. It's a great time to look at all senses for healing. It's a great time to look at what things you're doing, not from a guilt or blame or shame or any of that other stuff. We're talking about, take a real look at what's going on and say, I wonder how I can change this situation in the here and the now. And we can't have to worry about the rest of the world, but the only reason I wanted you to see the statistics, I was actually kind of blown away by that because I thought cigarettes were going to be kind of come the thing of the past, but no. And I got to emphasize, do double-blind placebo-controlled trials really change behavior? Answer is no. Good marketing does. Yes.
Should you use a far infrared sauna when you have a diagnosis of cancer?
Great question, and it hasn't been studied. And I can come up with reasons that it's detoxing. Far infrared saunas are great for detox, and I think they're great for preventative health. I'd be a little bit concerned about tumor vascularity and a bunch of other types of things if I had a far infrared sauna and using it. So would I use it? And I'm just talking about, this is my belief about it without good trials. Because some things can be studied with trials, right? There's no studies. Nobody really wants to look at that question. And if I had a far infrared sauna, I wouldn't do any kind of cancer treatment because I could come up with ways where it might be negative. Okay? Yeah. So from a primary prevention standpoint, I think it's a great thing, far infrared saunas, detoxification. Would I use it as part of a cancer treatment program? Probably not. Now, when I say that, there are hyperthermia, but that's a different, there's hyperthermia in combination with other things that you can use in conjunction, okay? But doing far infrared sauna on its own without a lot of other things, a little bit iffy. Sorry. Other questions? Has this been too gloom and doom?
First of all, thank you so much. Sure. Very, very informative. Because I see whole history. I see whole history. And I think sometimes when we get into special stuff, this is the real deal. It does work.
No, I agree. And there is hope out of this. That's what I'm saying as far as it goes. But everybody has to kind of take back and be their own authority in terms of their health. not from going on WebMD and coming up with your own chemotherapy protocol. Because if you can outsmart your chemotherapy doctor in terms of picking your protocol, you need a new chemotherapy doctor. Okay? And so we're talking about actually doing things. Because I see so many people are busy measuring stuff and going online. And how many times did you meditate today? Well, instead of going online, how many times did you? The active role that they could be playing in their own healthcare, they've completely thrown away by becoming researchers. And so they actually need to be actively involved in their own healthcare, not just finding different new ways to second guess their doctors. Yes, sorry.
I'd like to give people an opportunity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, mindfulness practices are wonderful no matter what you do, and especially if you look at pain management, which is obviously a part of this, and that's why the quality of life stuff that improves with meditation and cancer is really especially less levels of pain. And I think a lot to do with that kind of principle. The meditation practice has shown that you still have pain when you have the cancers or whatever else, but the areas of the brain associated with suffering actually stop metabolizing as much. So you can have pain without suffering. And that's a lot to do with being present moment with what the pain is. And so there's a lot to be learned from pain. You never wish it on anybody, of course, okay? But if pain is present, can you be present with it? And the answer is yes. And it makes a huge difference in terms of suffering, which is a different thing. And nobody likes the saying that everybody experiences pain, but suffering is a choice. But there's actually a lot of truth to it. And so don't want to forget, before we keep on answering questions, please, if you like things tonight, support Make-A-Wish. They do a wonderful job, especially for kids with cancer and things like that. Anybody who needs to go, please feel free to. There was somebody first, Jenny. Yes? Exactly what I'm recommending. It can become a little bit of a power struggle, and so that's because most of the oncologists, this is very threatening to them. And remember, most of the times the surgeons were the dominant forces and they hated the chemotherapy doctors. Now the chemotherapy doctors are kind of the top dogs in the industry now, so they kind of look down on everybody else because they're the top dogs. And so it's a little bit challenging for them when they get their knowledge bases. You know, most doctors have a lot of ego and that this is challenging to them. But what I actually tell people is, listen, you don't want me second-guessing chemotherapy regimens. You don't want me second-guessing the way somebody gives radiation therapy because I have to know about it, but I shouldn't know it as well as they do. Okay. However, all this stuff I know so much better than the doctors because I've actually looked at it with an objective thing, which is, wow, I wouldn't use IVC in this and this, but I would use it in this and this, even if the chemotherapy doctor says no, because because I'm looking at the science of it, not the belief system of it. And that becomes a challenging thing. And it's a challenging thing for the patient. They have to be willing to say, can I go there? Okay. Can I do something that my ivory tower doctor says I shouldn't be doing? Because it becomes a challenge. So it's something somebody has to have a little gumption, because otherwise, you know, I had a patient, relatively recently who died. And I think primarily, I think we could have really done a lot to help her if she would just listen to what we did. But she kept on listening to the forces around her telling her not to do what I was telling her to do. And she just wasn't a good candidate to see me because she really wasn't ready for the message. And again, you know, I was laughing because outside my office, I mean, the guy next door got chickens, okay, and a rooster. And that's like, here I am sitting in Aurora Grande with chickens clucking outside my things. How do you know you're a podunk doctor in a podunk town when there's chickens going on outside your window? It's like, yeah, I've got a high potency authority here, like this, you know, it's like that. It's like what's that? Oh, it's the chickens next door. You know, I know it's not as impressive as the ivory tower, but I've got chickens. So it's kind of tough. Do I believe this Aurora Grande doctor with this, you know, stuff? Most people who meet me know that I know what I'm talking about. I've been part of a university and all this other stuff. So, you know, but it's tough when you got chickens. no, trust me. But yes, if the person's ready and really willing to look at this kind of stuff, because you have to understand, when there's a lot of stress, getting one other layer of information that contradicts what somebody else is saying can be very stressful. So I understand when people, the lady who passed, I understand why it was too much for her. It just was, okay? So that the person has to be ready for this kind of information. And that's, in a perfect world, the integrative oncologist would be part of the team and would be the one prescribing nutrition, the exercise, the supplements, and all those things to work together with the oncologist. We're not quite there yet in terms of having the oncologist accept what we do because it's beyond their knowledge basis, and it's threatening. Yes. Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah, do you have any comment on Rogan?
Yes. Dr. Simoncini from Italy had a theory, okay, and still has one actually, that cancer is caused by fungus. Okay, now that's unequivocally been shown to be not true. But as part of his theory, he started doing IV bicarbonate and all of these other things, and intra-arterial IV bicarb directly into tumors and a variety of other things, having some success in his trials. He's unfortunately been kicked out of every country because of he's really kind of off the deep end in many ways, okay, which I have nothing against. I like people like that. But that being stated, it's been difficult for anybody to reproduce any of his results. And on average, you could say doing things to help alkalinize people can be beneficial during cancer. How you do it and a variety of other things is the issue. Okay. But the Simoncini principle of fungus causing cancer is not valid. The principle of using bicarbonate and alkaline and acid-based balance is going to be a huge part of metabolic therapy for cancers in the future. Some of the doctors working with them will be a presentation in the future about how you can really take advantage of cancer biology to treat it at a very core level using very basic medicines and supplements, sometimes hyperthermia, etc., to actually get to the root of using the glycolysis, the acid-base balance within the cancer, and actually treating cancer. That's something that's coming down the road. So using part of that theory is actually, I think, going to be quite profoundly beneficial in the treatment of cancer.
I just have a question about somebody to go on a
cleanse. The question is detox, and I recommend detoxes as a primary preventive therapy for everybody. I say do some form of detox. That's its own lecture series. All right, so 3 times a year, okay? There's a variety of ways of doing that. What I would tell you is when you're treating cancer, you need to get right into the treatment usually, and the detox part of it is usually afterwards. So the lady I saw today, really, I thought had some profound insights into her cancer. We actually started on a detox as part of her long-term healing. It's too difficult. The person is often too toxic that the detox is that much more difficult when you have cancer. So in general, the answer is no. I don't recommend detox before other therapies.
Getting back to
that, was
E12 or...
See, that's always been the issue is, you know, because the other things I haven't gone into is cancer systemic from the beginning? Does everybody have some degrees of circulating tumor cells? Do they have, even worse than that, circulating cancer stem cells? Okay. And I'm proposing some theories. The question is, and those things, do you ever even get over cancer? Are there always some cancer circulating stem cells decades later? Okay. And I'm not trying to be scary. These are questions, not answers. Okay. And so is the person ever free of high blood pressure if their medicine, the blood pressure is down? And the answer is sometimes not, because if they stop the medicine or they change their diet, their blood pressure comes back. Okay. So the question with cancer is, do we ever completely excise it? And like I said, I don't mean this from a scary standpoint. But can you rely on the CAT scans being negative or just tumor antigens being negative? Don't know. So the question is always, when can I go back to real life, so to speak? You know, just do the normal things for my normal, healthy self. In general, I wouldn't do anything if I've had a tumor. I wouldn't continue tumor promoters. Okay, and I'd count on my diet to get those nutrients and take nutrients that are more specific and not take the ones that I know might be there and might promote a circulating cancer tumor cell. And I don't want people running around worried 20 years later and thinking about that way. But I think that's a useful idea, is to look at this as a chronic disease. Can we make cancer into a chronic disease? Just like high blood pressure, just like diabetes, just like, et cetera, heart disease. That's kind of the goal. And I would tell people, you know, be very careful about taking supplements that might have a problem. Remember, you know, we've done all kinds of supplement talks. Oh, sorry. Down supplement talks, and if you take the wrong supplements, you can really get wrong results. Okay, so the wrong form of vitamin E, taking the wrong we've way past the idea of supplements just being expensive urine, right? If they can kill you, they certainly must be doing something. Okay, so that's why really take the supplement thing super seriously. And so but on average, I have most people on a multivitamin from a preventive health standpoint. If I think the cancer is completely cured from a variety of things, yes, I can put people back on a normal routine. Sorry. We got to get going. So thank you all. Thank you.